This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 31st, 2013. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, as student loan interest rates are set to rise in a few weeks, protesters say corporations are profiting off the ballooning student debt. A two-week-long conference on Indigenous issues wraps up at the UN. We'll speak to Indigenous women leaders about the challenges they're facing back at home. And this weekend marks the first National Day of Civic Hacking. One group wants to see what developers can do with tens of thousands of pages of files detailing US torture policies. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In Istanbul, protesters angry over a government plan to replace a city park with a shopping mall have clashed with police for the fourth straight day. Turkish media have already dubbed the actions an Occupy-style movement. Demonstrations continued this evening, even though a city court has issued an injunction against the project. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
For the second straight day, police fired gas canisters in a pre-dawn raid to evict a peaceful encampment trying to save Gezi Park. Turkish media agencies captured the melee that left scores injured and at least one young man dead from a reported heart attack after being pepper sprayed by police. By 10 a.m., the protesters had been evicted, but a crowd gathered outside the park with passing motorists honking and waving in support. But the euphoria didn't last. In less than an hour, police were back on the streets firing pepper gas, trying to disperse a larger crowd which had gathered in Taksim Square. The afternoon descended into running street battles that paralyzed the central shopping district and led to at least 60 arrests. Organizer Betul Tanbay says the prime minister has attempted to bypass the planning process by issuing blanket decrees.
What is done right now is illegal. It has not been approved by any authority. The municipality and the construction company are invading the park illegally.
This evening, an Istanbul court announced an injunction against the shopping mall project, but few on the ground seem to be taking the ruling seriously. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
In Germany today, activists with the Blockupy movement expressed solidarity with the Turkish protesters. In a major protest action, demonstrators in Frankfurt surrounded the European Central Bank and the Deutsche Bank headquarters in the morning. They tried to block business activities in the city center in protest of the financial institutions' roles in the economic troubles of the continent. Some clashes with riot police have been reported. Video posted online show activists shaking police fences, pushing up against police on sidewalks, and a scattered group marching through the streets in the rain, with drummers providing a soundtrack. A smaller group of demonstrators then moved to the Frankfurt airport, where they occupied a terminal holding signs demanding an end to Germany's deportation policies. Organizers posted on Twitter that they will resume protests Saturday morning. Nigerian lawmakers have passed a bill making anyone involved in same-sex marriage subject to up to 14 years in prison. Nigeria's population is largely comprised of conservative Christians and Muslims, and many are strongly opposed to LGBT rights. FSRN Sam Olikoya reports from Lagos.
The bill to criminalize same-sex marriage received overwhelming support from members of the Nigerian House of Representatives. The Senate passed a similar bill in 2011. And now the law will go to President Goodluck Jonathan for a signature. Jonathan is considered likely to bow to public pressure and support the legislation. The proposed law also targets people who support same-sex marriage and makes any public display of LGBT relationships punishable by a decade in prison. Over the past decade, Nigeria's gay and lesbian population has become more visible. People involved in same-sex relationships are often attacked when identified. Nigerian gays and lesbians say any law against them will legitimize the public hostility and violence. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The government of Myanmar has come to a ceasefire agreement with the Kachin Independence Army, based in the northern part of the country, also known as Burma. Over the past 2 years, after a 15-year-old ceasefire was broken, the armed group has engaged in heavy fighting with government soldiers in the region along the Chinese border. The Kachin Workers Association Thailand reports more than 75,000 people in the state have been displaced by fighting. The Myanmar military has also been accused of sexual violence, targeted killings, and forcing the local population into labor on its behalf. One of the key promises of the current tentative ceasefire is the start of a political dialogue between the groups. Army Private Bradley Manning's court-martial starts on Monday, and solidarity protests are planned this weekend all over the United States and internationally. A group in Tampa will rally at MacDill Air Force Base, where U.S. Central Command is located. FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports.
Bradley Manning faces life in prison for releasing classified information to the whistleblowing site WikiLeaks. The information uncovered military attacks on civilians in Iraq, among other things. Susie Shannon is one of the organizers of the Tampa rally. She worries a conviction could pose a major threat to journalistic sources.
The hope, I think, of the Obama administration is that they shut people up and that they shut down journalistic sources. And that's a danger to everyone, because we can't have a democracy, we can't make decisions about our world and our country if we don't know what's going on.
Protests are also planned at U.S. embassies and consulates in Rome, London, Toronto, and Seoul, as well as Fort Meade, Maryland, where Manning is jailed. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. In Washington today, President Obama renewed his call to keep student loan rates affordable, slamming a measure by House Republicans passed earlier this month that he says will hurt young people and their families. Interest rates are set to double to 6.8% on July 1st if Congress doesn't act. And there's growing concern about the rising amount of student debt, which at about $1 trillion outpaces credit card balances and car loans. The president's remarks follow a protest yesterday outside Sallie Mae headquarters, where students gathered to demand loan modifications and political transparency. Activists say the corporation, which holds the most privately owned loans in the country, has promoted legislation that would negatively impact the students it's supposed to serve. In Washington, FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
The federal government offers subsidized Stafford loans to low-income students at a relatively low interest rate of 3.4%. Last year, when that rate was set to double, Congress reached a bipartisan agreement to grant a one-year extension to keep the rate from increasing. Now the year is up, and the House has passed a bill that supporters say will solve the problem. Under the bill's provisions, Congress would no longer be responsible for setting the rates on Stafford loans. Instead, they would be tied to the rates of 10-year Treasury bonds plus 2.5%, with a cap on overall interest at 8.5%.
Unfortunately, their bill does not meet that test.
The president criticized the bill Friday, surrounded by students in the Rose Garden.
It fails to lock in low rates for students next year. That's not smart. It eliminates safeguards for lower-income families. That's not fair. It could actually cost a freshman starting school this fall more over the next 4 years than if we did nothing at all and let the interest rates double on July 1st.
The president's 2014 budget included a plan that would also tie Stafford loan rates to Treasury bond rates, but the additional premium would be less than 1%. The rates would not be capped, but unlike the plan put forth by the House, they would be fixed, so that when a student takes out a loan, the initial interest rate would not change over the life of the loan. The financial corporation Sallie Mae services a portion of Stafford loans and owns over $160 billion in student loans outright. Between 2008 and 2012, the company spent about $16 million on lobbying at the state and federal levels. Chris Hicks, an organizer for the activist group Jobs with Justice, says that given Sallie Mae's stake in the student loan industry, its political activities are cause for concern. He says the bank has also been involved with the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which drafts model legislation for lawmakers.
We know last November they actually presented at ALEC a workshop called Best Practices for Debt Collection and Tax Amnesty. So they're pushing all these At the state level, they're pushing all these bills that remove protections for the borrowers, where you can only get called so many times, the different ways you go about debt collection, like not faxing something to a place of work. So they're playing a really big role in setting the rules, And that's bad for students. It's bad for families.
Hicks says that Sallie Mae lobbyists have already influenced the debate over federal student loan rates.
This whole IRS scandal, one of the nonprofits that was investigated was called American Action Network, which is led by a Sallie Mae lobbyist and a Goldman Sachs lobbyist. And they spent 66% of their budget on political donations, well over the allowed 49%. So they overspent by about $15 million. One of the politicians they helped fund was Senator Johnson from Wisconsin, gave him $750,000 in 2011, and he voted three times to allow the federal interest rate to double.
Hicks was among 150 students and organizers who gathered outside of Sallie Mae's headquarters during the bank's annual shareholder meeting Thursday in Stanton, Delaware. 26 people from the group attended the shareholder meeting and asked executives to fully disclose all of their lobbying activities. They also asked Sallie Mae's new CEO, Jack Remondi, to meet with students to discuss loan modification and principal reductions. Sam Nelson, a history student at George Washington University, says he's $50,000 in debt. He became an activist around student debt during the Occupy movement and attended Thursday's shareholder meeting.
The student debt struggle that we're going through is definitely one battle in that broader fight about what is education for, and if it is to benefit society, then shouldn't it be a right and free and accessible to all?
Remondi committed to meeting with students within a month, but has not yet set a date. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Many are continuing to ask questions following the FBI's killing of a man in Orlando, Florida last week. Speaking from Russia, Abdulbaki Todashev told CNN his son Ibrahim was shot seven times, including once in the head.
My son was definitely unarmed because he never had a gun. He couldn't attack them or fight them. He couldn't do anything because even two men could easily handle him. There were four or five of them, all armed. He didn't pose any threat to them, but even if he threatened them with his fists, couldn't they shoot his leg? My son couldn't attack them because he's not crazy. I don't know how they could shoot him like that.
The FBI was questioning Todashev in Orlando about what he knew about the Boston bombing suspects. For more on the situation, WMNF's Sean Kinane spoke to Hassan Shibli, executive director of CARE Florida in Tampa. Sean started by asking Shibli why they're calling for a civil rights investigation into the death of Ibrahim Todashev.
Well, the bottom line is that a man who was unarmed was shot and killed. He was shot seven times, once in the back of the head, by an FBI agent after 5 hours of interrogation in his house. So that, for us, raises a lot of questions. You know, at this point, we're not accusing anyone of anything, but we have a lot of unanswered questions, and we're looking for those answers. And I think there's really two major issues here at play. One is, you know, were his constitutional rights violated during that 4 or 5 hour interrogation that occurred in his house? And secondly, was excessive force used against him when he was shot seven times, once in the back of the head at the end of the interview?
You say he was unarmed. Some of the law enforcement officials say that he wielded a knife or wielded a sword. What's the story there? How do you know he was unarmed?
The interesting thing is, unfortunately, the law enforcement officials have not been able to keep their story straight. And that's why I think it's very important that we keep a watchful eye on them. And the whole purpose of this is really to keep them straight, keep them honest, and make sure that our law enforcement officers are abiding by the highest standards. So initially, yes, there was reports that he had a, first we heard gun, then that was debunked. Then they said knife, then they retracted. No, there was no knife. Then later they said a sword. And now through our contacts, we've confirmed through senior FBI leadership that he in fact was not in possession of any such thing when he was shot. There was a decorative model, not sharp model sword on the wall in that room where he was being interviewed. And for me, that raises some questions. And by the way, this had a broken handle, so it wasn't really an effective weapon. And my question is, look, if you're interviewing a guy you think is a murderer or a criminal, are you doing your due diligence to interrogate him for 4 or 5 hours in a room with something that you perceive to be a weapon?
Some of the reports say that there was a scuffle right before the shooting, that the person who was shot was throwing furniture or getting angry, and that the FBI felt threatened. What is it that you've learned from your sources?
Well, we did hear that he may have potentially pushed the table, you know, the small living room table that was between him and the officer. Look, it's never, ever justifiable to attack or aggress against law enforcement officers. That's very clear. Again, our issue is more about the procedure. What happened? Why was he interrogated for 5 hours? And did pushing a table justify 7 shots, 1 in the back of the head? I mean, law enforcement officers, especially local law enforcement, have very high standards of when they can use lethal force. And we want to make sure that federal enforcement officers also abide by those high standards. Not that they interrogate someone for 5 hours in his house and he says, maybe like, get out of my house, and pushes a table, and then he's met with 7 bullets in return. So again, we want to hold them to the high standards. And remember, this isn't just about the victim of the shooting. This isn't just about his family, but it's more about our principles as Americans, our constitutional protections and freedoms. We want to make sure those principles are not being violated by law enforcement.
Remind people why the FBI were speaking to him in the first place. What is the connection here to the murders in Boston and even the connection to the Boston Marathon suspect?
So it's very important to remember that he was cooperating with the FBI for several weeks. In fact, this individual had a ticket out of the country. I mean, he could have left, but he thought, you know what? He was naive. He thought, oh, I don't have anything to hide. Let me speak with them. Let me clear my name. In fact, they told him, look, we're just going to clear your name. This is going to be the last interview we do with you. And sure enough, it was the last interview, just not as anyone could have imagined. And the reason the FBI was questioning him initially was because he lived in Boston. He went to he's of the same ethnic origin as the terrorist suspects in Boston. Not that, you know, it's interesting because I don't think the FBI questions all the ethnic members of other terrorist groups, but that's a whole other question to think about. But the point is, he lived in Boston, and he had about 2 years ago, and he had known the suspect. He was shocked at what happened. He wasn't close friends with him. He was just an acquaintance. I think they attended the same gym. And that was really why they were questioning him. He had never prior to that point been questioned about any murders that we're aware of, nor were any of his friends or his family members. In fact, his wife right now has evidence that he was with her in Atlanta at the time when those murders allegedly took place.
That was Hassan Shibley, Executive Director of CARE Florida in Tampa, speaking to WMNF's Sean Kinane. To see a video of this interview, go to WMNF.org. This weekend is the first National Day of Civic Hacking. The initiative is sponsored by Intel, supported by the White House Office of Digital Strategy and a range of other federal and state agencies and corporations. About 90 hacking events are taking place across the country, from Alaska to Florida. The aim, according to the organizers' website, is to promote transparency, participation, and collaboration between governments, companies, and citizens. The American Civil Liberties Union is also taking part by releasing tens of thousands of pages of files detailing torture of detainees by the Bush administration. To tell us more, we're joined by Alex Abdo, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks so much for having me.
When hacking's done for a good cause, it's often about exposing hidden information to hold organizations accountable. You've pointed out that the files government agencies and corporations are opening up to the public are really just practical and uncontroversial information like transit schedules and restaurant inspection documents. Tell us more about the sort of information that is being released here.
Well, I should start by saying that we're excited that the government is promoting National Day of Civic Hacking. It seems like a worthwhile endeavor for government agencies to open up their files to those who want to hack for social good. But when we looked at the files that were being opened up mainly for the public, they were, as you said, files relating to convenience of daily life, things like train schedules, bus routes, and the like.
You said you're pleased that the White House is supporting this National Day of Civic Hacking, but the White House also has a record of aggressively pursuing information against activists, including Aaron Swartz and Jeremy Hammond, who pleaded guilty this week for hacking into the private intelligence company Stratfor. How does the government's definition of a hacker differ from what's seen by the activist community?
Well, I think there are any number of definitions of hackers, but I think like many things, hacking is it's a tool. It's, I think, to many people, it's an ethos. It's a way of looking at the world of tinkering and trying to find how things work. And that skill set or that ethos can, of course, be abused. And at times, the abuse can be criminal. But the government, you know, has, of course, I think, abused its prosecutorial discretion at times. And that's something to be wary of. But, you know, for this moment, at least, I think it's worth celebrating the possibilities of good that can come of hacking for social good. And we want to, I think, capitalize on the moment by contributing to.
you're opening up what you call your torture database, which contains tens of thousands of pages of documents obtained primarily through Freedom of Information Act requests. And those documents detail the US government's torture around the world after the September 11 attacks. Can you tell us more about the contents of this archive and what might developers do with it?
So far, we've uncovered about 130,000 to 150,000 pages of the primary source documentation of torture under the Bush administration. Things like legal memos that authorized the CIA to use waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques, emails sent by FBI agents complaining about and reporting on the abuse that they witnessed at Guantanamo and other detention facilities, or even things as harrowing as autopsy reports conducted by medical examiners in the Army after detainees died in custody, a number of whom died during or shortly after interrogation. So that there's a really a broad array of information in our database, and we spent a long time thinking about the categories of information that should be tagged in each of the documents. And we came up with over a dozen different categories of metadata tags to allow for very easy searching and indexing of the documents. And that metadata, I think, is very rich and what makes this a unique opportunity for developers. They'll have access not only to the documents themselves, but to the various ways in which we've tagged them all. And we hope that they can use that very rich set of metadata to visualize the documents in an interesting way. So you can imagine someone would look at the ways in which various officials are mentioned over time, so you can get a sense of who was involved in the program when, or you can look at the number of incidents involving particular interrogation techniques, how those evolve over time, so you can get a sense of when particular techniques were approved, when they fell out of favor, when they were observed most.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on how you hope this information is going to be converted into something that helps transparency and accountability?
Sure. One of the things we realized a long time ago is that there's no shortage of information, publicly available information about the Bush administration's use of torture and other harsh interrogation techniques. Public awareness of those facts is not where it should be. And I think that's in part because we haven't done our job of making the data as accessible as it should be. And that's in part because, we're lawyers and we're not experts in database management creation in getting this data out there. But we're hoping that others can help us do that. And that's why we're opening up the database to developers.
Alex Abdo, staff attorney for the ACLU's National Security Project. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks so much for having me.
At the United Nations in New York, a two-week-long meeting on Indigenous issues wraps up today. Indigenous women are participating in large numbers, examining health, human rights, sexual violence, culture, and education. While exposing the problems that exist for Indigenous women around the world, participants are also creating solutions. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports.
More than 2,000 Indigenous women from across the world gathered for the 12th session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Mirna Cunningham-Cain is a member of the forum and the president of the Center for Indigenous Peoples' Autonomy and Development in Nicaragua. She says one issue they are discussing is the health sector, where there is a big gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous women.
Just look at maternal mortality. Indigenous women are the ones that are dying the most. This means that although governments and UN agencies have increased the access to health services, these services are still not incorporating the cultural views of Indigenous women. So it means that we still have to push more to really change the way in which services are delivered.
Cunningham-Cain also says gaps exist in education, in which curriculum doesn't respect traditional knowledge or the traditional role that women play in society. Participants have also been discussing Indigenous women and land rights, control over income, involvement in decision-making, and what is being termed as corporate colonization of Indigenous lands. Joan Carling is the Secretary General of Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact.
This grabbing of our resources is weakening the traditional knowledge and the role of women in sustainable resource management. And that is something alarming, and that's what we're trying to prevent now, that development should respect our culture, our identity, our rights over our natural resources. And we can be partners for development as long as there is also respect to Mother Nature.
Activists also demand that states should ensure that the corporations who engage in extractive activities on indigenous lands and territories should abide by the, quote, free, prior and informed consent requirement under the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Myrna Cunningham-Kane says it creates an opportunity for dialogue.
It's a mechanism through which the government and whatever agency or corporation that wants to do something with indigenous peoples have the obligation to share previous information with them and to really tell them what will happen or what will not happen if that investment is not done or is done in the community.
Violence against indigenous women is endemic in most parts of the world. They face violence at home, from outside their communities, as well as during armed conflicts. Danica Littlechild is an indigenous lawyer and a survivor of sexual violence.
This can happen to any indigenous woman. You just have to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and have somebody think that you're not really a human being, that your life is not worthy of being respected, that your body is not worthy of being respected.
Many advocates say the root causes of sexual violence against Native women should be addressed. Erin Consmo is with the Native Youth Sexual Health Network.
I think that we need to recognize where sexual violence comes from, and it's the histories of ongoing colonialism and colonization and the effects of that on our bodies as Indigenous peoples. And until we address the initial roots of the right to sovereignty and self-determination of our territories, of our lands, that we're not going to see decreases in sexual violence, because it is those root causes that we're not addressing.
Faced with these challenges, some indigenous communities have turned to their own laws and culture. Danica Littlechild says a neighboring indigenous community near her home in Alberta, Canada, brought back indigenous traditional laws called rites of passage, which provides a process for youth to resolve serious societal issues.
After they brought in these rites of passage again, which really taught children and women and men more and more about what their role is, what respect is, how relationships should be, that they saw an exponential decrease in teen pregnancies, they saw decreases in sexually transmitted infections, they saw decreases in violence, because suddenly children becoming adults understood the appropriate way to behave with one another using their own knowledge and their own laws, not somebody else's.
And in many places, Native women have also begun to organize themselves better than before. Joan Carling of Asia Indigenous Peoples Pact says she is inspired by seeing women resisting oppression and discrimination.
That's really very encouraging. So we want to provide support for women to come together, strengthen themselves, build their capacity and act in to their situation, because it's ultimately they will be the one to change their condition.
In addition to issues facing women and youth, participants also focused on the rights and inclusion of indigenous peoples with disabilities, as well as the creation of a voluntary mechanism that would hear complaints about violations of indigenous rights. The UN Indigenous Forum wraps up Friday. The next gathering is a world conference on indigenous issues, scheduled for September 2014. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, at the United Nations.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.